Welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast, where we explore the kind of thinking we need to navigate a positive way forward. I'm your host, Maura Gamble, permaculture educator and global ambassador, filmmaker, eco-villager, food forester, mother, practivist, and all-round lover of thinking, communicating, and acting regeneratively. For a long time, it's been clear to me that to shift trajectory to a thriving one planet way of life, we first need to shift our thinking. The way we perceive ourselves in relation to nature, self, and community is the core. So this is true now more than ever, and even the way change is changing is changing. Unprecedented changes are happening all around us at a rapid pace. So how do we make sense of this? To know which way to turn, to know what action to focus on, so our efforts are worthwhile and nourishing and are working towards resilience, regeneration, and reconnection. What better way to make sense than to join together with others in open, generative conversation? In this podcast, I'll share conversations with my friends and colleagues, people who inspire and challenge me in their ways of thinking, connecting, and acting. These wonderful people are thinkers, doers, activists, scholars, writers, leaders, farmers, educators, people whose work informs permaculture and spark the imagination of what a post-COVID, climate-resilient, socially just future could look like. Their ideas and projects help us to make sense in this changing world, to compost and digest the ideas, and to nurture the fertile ground for new ideas, connections, and actions. Together, we'll open up conversations in the world of permaculture design, regenerative thinking, community action, earth repair, eco-literacy, and much more. I can't wait to share these conversations with you. Over the last three decades of personally making sense of the multiple crises we face, I always return to the practical and positive world of permaculture, with its ethics of earth care, people care, and fair share. I've seen firsthand how adaptable and responsive it can be in all contexts, from urban to rural, from refugee camps to suburbs. It helps people make sense of what's happening around them and to learn accessible design tools to shape their habitat positively and to contribute to cultural and ecological regeneration. This is why I've created the Permaculture Educators Program, to help thousands of people to become permaculture teachers everywhere through an interactive online dual certificate of permaculture design and teaching. We sponsor global perma-youth programs, women's self-help groups in the global south, and teens in refugee camps. So anyway, this podcast is sponsored by the Permaculture Education Institute and our Permaculture Educators Program. If you'd like to find more about permaculture, I've created a four-part permaculture video series to explain what permaculture is and also how you can make it your livelihood as well as your way of life. We'd love to invite you to join our wonderfully inspiring, friendly and supportive global learning community. So I welcome you to share each of these conversations, and I'd also like to suggest you create a local conversation circle to explore the ideas shared in each show and discuss together how this makes sense in your local community and environment. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I meet and speak with you today, the Gubbi Gubbi people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. It's my great pleasure and honour to welcome Fritjof Capra to this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World. I was 22 when I first came across his writings, although my dad had introduced me to his books long before and told me how important they were. And what he wrote, what Fritjof wrote, made deep sense to me at that time. I read his book, The Turning Point, and then Belonging to the Universe, and that changed everything. I kind of see my life as before Turning Point and after Turning Point. I heard that he was teaching a five-week residential course at a place called Schumacher College in Devon, named after another iconic thinker, E.F. Schumacher. And both Fritjof and Schumacher's thinking are underpinning permaculture as well, which is important to keep in mind. So anyway, I went and I studied with him with a global cohort, and we've been friends ever since. So it's really a great pleasure to be inviting him here to this podcast and also bringing into the conversation two of the Perma Youth leaders, my daughter and her friend Eve. So just a little bit more of a background about Fritjof. Fritjof is a scientist, educator, activist, and author. His focus has been around education and helping to build and nurture sustainable communities. His first book, Back in 1975 was the Tao of Physics, which is and it continues to be incredibly popular, still in print in 40 editions worldwide. His most recent book, The Systems View of Life, published by Cambridge University Press, is sort of like a grand synthesis of his work. And he also has a course, an online course, that's based around this book called The Capra Course. And the Perma Youth are about to launch into being part of this Capra Course under the direct mentorship of Fritjof himself, which is an incredibly exciting thing. Some of the other books that he's written, as well as The Turning Point and Belonging to the Universe, which I mentioned, The Web of Life, The Hidden Connections, The Science of Leonardo, and Learning from Leonardo, as well as having co-written a screenplay for Mindwalk, a film based on his work. He's the founding director of the Center for Eco-Literacy in Berkeley. He's also a fellow of Schumacher College, and he serves on the council of the Earth Charter Initiative. He recently also made a short film about the SDGs. So I've put some links of all of this down below, and I really hope that you'll dive into those resources and share this discussion widely. I'm really honoured that he'd taken the time to talk with these young people, 12-year-old and 14-year-old girls from the Perma Youth, who had some really big questions they wanted to ask him. So I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did spending this time with Fritjof. So welcome to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast. It's my great pleasure today to introduce a dear friend of mine, Fritjof Capra. Fritjof, I met when I was 23. At Schumacher College, he was leading an intensive program called The Web of Life. And I think it was at that point that everything started to make sense for me. So it's really apt that we're inviting you here with these young women from the Perma Youth, Maya, my daughter, and Eve, to really talk about some of the questions that will help them to make sense of what's going on and to share the insights that you have from a systems perspective. And we're going to be talking a little bit later on as we move forward about your book, The Systems, I don't know if you can see that, The Systems View of Life. And so we're working with Maya and the Perma Youth too to find a way to access that material for them and to really uncover a sense of eco-literacy and eco-design and a deeper understanding of the world. Both of these girls are homeschooled and have brilliant minds, and so it's really wonderful to be able to join you together. Thanks, Fritjof, for joining us. A typical thing that we do in Australia is a welcome to country. It's a acknowledgement of Indigenous community. So Maya is going to do that.
So I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we each respectively meet and belong to. And for me, it's the Gubbi Gubbi land, which was never ceded. And I also pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. So.
Yeah, thanks, Maya.
Thank you. Well, it's a great pleasure to join you in this experiment, I should say, because I've never had a, you know, sustained conversation with young people. And I'm very happy to do it with you, Morak. You are by far my most brilliant student.
Wow,
I'm very happy to, you know, pass that on to the next generation with your help, and really look forward to this conversation.
It's a pleasure to meet you. And the first question I have to ask you is, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yes, pleasure to meet you, Eve, and Maya too. Well, I am a scientist and writer, and I'm also an environmental educator and activist. And I didn't start out like this, obviously. I started out as a physicist. I was trained in physics, got my PhD in Austria. I'm Austrian. So at the University of Vienna, I got my PhD in the 1960s. And I spent 20 years doing research in high energy physics, which is the physics of subatomic particles. And from my student years, I was very interested in the philosophy of physics, and especially in the philosophy implied by quantum theory, the theory of atomic physics. This was formulated in the early part of the 20th century, during the first three decades of the 20th century, and it was a very dramatic story. There were a handful of physicists like Albert Einstein, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and a few more, and they began to make experiments involving atoms for the first time. And what they found was totally shocking to them, because this world of atoms and subatomic particles was nothing like the everyday world we experience in our surroundings. There were no separate objects, but rather there was a network of relationships. And when they investigated this network of relationships, they found that it was very dynamic. The further you go to smaller and smaller dimensions, the more dynamic and active this material world becomes. And so this network was really a kind of dance of energy. And so it took them about three decades to really understand how to describe this world of atoms and subatomic particles. And when I studied physics in the 1960s, at the same time, I became interested in Eastern philosophy, in the spiritual traditions of Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism. And almost immediately, I saw significant parallels between the worldview presented by these Eastern spiritual teachers and the worldview that emerged in modern physics. And so 10 years later, I published a book called The Tao of Physics, and I got a copy here, so you can see it has a meditating Buddha, and then it has these tracks of subatomic particles from physics laboratories. And so I explored the parallels between modern physics and Eastern mysticism. And this book was tremendously successful, more successful than I had ever dreamed or imagined. And so as a consequence, I was invited to give lectures and seminars to all kinds of audiences, beginning in London, where I lived at the time, and then all over the world. And I talked to professionals of all walks of life, and many of them told me that this change of paradigms, as it was called, from a mechanistic view to a holistic and what I called an ecological view, was not only happening in physics, but in many other fields. And so I explored these other fields and spent the next 30 years designing a grand synthesis of this new paradigm, which I call the systems view of life. And that's the title of my latest book, which is a textbook published by Cambridge University Press, and it's called The Systems View of Life. So that's briefly what I have been doing. I have been teaching this systems view of life at Schumacher College. I now teach it in an online course called CAPRA course, which I have held for 4 years now, and I have a network of alumni around the world of 1,500 or more. And so my activity is writing, researching, teaching, and helping to create a better world, a more sustainable future. So that's what I do.
And thanks for doing that, because that's inspired. I mean, it's certainly inspired our family, and I know so many. And it inspired permaculture. The underpinning work that you've done is very much the foundation of the thinking and the philosophy behind things like permaculture. I see them as an applied systems thinking.
Uh-huh. And that's really an Australian connection, right? Because permaculture started Australia, right?
Yeah.
So how would you describe the new paradigm, and how would you suggest that we transition to that?
Well, that's really two questions. So let's split that into two questions, okay? And I'll talk about the first. Change from a mechanistic worldview to a holistic or systemic view, to sum it up in a nutshell, in a single sentence, it's really a change, a very fundamental change of metaphors, from seeing the world as a machine to understanding it as a network. So what I just told you before, that we have learned in quantum physics that the material world at the very small level of atoms and subatomic particles is not a world of separate objects, but rather a world of patterns of relationships, a network of relationships. And that's true not only for atomic physics, but it's true for life in general. So in ecology, well, first of all, I should say, you all know about social networks. You young people, you live in social networks. Well, they are very important in our culture, in our society. In ecology, ecologists speak of food webs, which are networks of feeding relationships. And then biologists tell us that a cell is a network of molecules, a network of chemical processes. So one of the most important discoveries of 20th century science has been that the network is the basic pattern of organization of all living systems. And when you ask yourselves, what is a network? Well, everybody knows what a network is. It's a certain nonlinear pattern of links, of relationships. And so in order to understand networks, we need to be able to think in terms of patterns and in terms of relationships. And this is what is called systemic thinking or systems thinking in science. So this is essentially what the new paradigm is, to think about the world in terms of networks. And let me just mention one consequence, which is maybe the most important consequence of this shift from the machine to the network. And that is, when you think of the major problems of our time, energy, environment, economic inequality, violence and war, the climate emergency, now the COVID pandemic, what you realize very soon is that none of these problems can be solved in isolation. They're all interconnected and interdependent. In fact, Eve mentioned that in one of the introduction to one of the questions she sent in. So these are systemic problems, interconnected and interdependent. And let me just, as an example, take the COVID pandemic that is very much on our minds these days. So as you may know, it started from an ecological imbalance. Over the last few decades, humanity has massively impacted ecosystems all over the world and has intruded into these ecosystems. And in doing so, has fractured this delicate web of life that an ecosystem is. And one of the many consequences of these harmful actions has been that viruses, which used to live in symbiosis with certain animal species, jumped from those animal species to others and to humans, where they were toxic and even deadly. And so the coronavirus, as we now know, jumped from a species of bats in China to humans and rapidly spread around the world. And when you look at the spread of the coronavirus, you see that the key variable is population density, because we get infected when we crowd together. This is why we now have our social distancing. Now, where are people crowded together? Well, from a systemic point of view, you can see that very often this is caused by excessive profit maximizing by corporations and by social inequality. So, for example, one of the main hotspots were cruise ships. On these cruise ships, people are packed together in very small cabins. Why do they have small cabins? Well, because the cruise companies think if we make the cabins very small, people don't like staying in the cabins and they go to the bar and spend money on drinks, or they go to a boutique and buy themselves a sweater, and we can make more money like that. Or, for example, you know, another hotspot, as you will have read, are meatpacking factories. Well, they shouldn't exist in the first place because it's cruel and inhumane to animals, and it produces unhealthy food. Well, now it's also a breeding ground for the coronavirus. And so we see that, for example, another example would be crowded living conditions, where, you know, 8 to 10 people live in a room instead of, you know, 1 or 2. And so economic inequality, you know, social injustice is a consequence. So we see that all these things are connected: ecological balance, social justice, and now the health consideration with the pandemic. And you can use that kind of thinking in many examples. So that would be my answer to the first question.
How would you suggest we transition?
Well, I think what we need to do is we need to educate ourselves. And, there are many ways we can transition, and we have to transition. But if you ask me, the answer will always be education, because that's what I do. And it is important. We need to educate ourselves about, in our thinking, about this change from the machine to the network. And we need to practice our thinking, and we need to act accordingly. Now, the good news is today there are hundreds of organizations around the world, of NGOs, of communities, of systemic thinkers and activists. And in order to transition, there's even an organization called Transition Network, which you may know, started with the Transition Town movement and then morphed into Transition Network. There's also a field of design, a new field called Transition Design. And there are literally hundreds of these organizations. And so the question is no longer where do we start, how do we transition, but which organization do we join? So that's the key issue.
Mm, great. Yeah, the transition movement is a really positive one. And interestingly, the Transition Town movement emerged directly out of permaculture. Because one of the projects of the course, Rob Hopkins was running a permaculture course in Ireland, and the project he set for his students was to look more broadly at how permaculture could be applied to changing the way that their town was in terms of getting ecological features, getting ecological livelihoods, and really thinking more broadly. And so they came up with this plan, this transition plan. Mm-hmm. And so from that point, the transition movement sort of emerged out of permaculture and went into that broader thinking, but very much has its roots in that. And I had a recent conversation with Rob about permaculture and transition town. Yeah.
You know, I have many connections with permaculture. Many of my students in the CAPRA course are, you know, practitioners of permaculture, and one is an editor of magazine, Permaculture Magazine. And what I noticed from my conversations with them is that the term permaculture has evolved over time from the meaning of culture in agriculture to the meaning of culture in a more general way. This is very interesting. And of course, you with your new perma youth movement are sort of the latest branch in this evolution. I find this really interesting. It's a very creative field, that field of permaculture.
Absolutely. And I would really love to maybe form a group within the alumni around permaculture and the systems view of life. I think that would be a really great initiative to bring us together. That would be good. Mm. So our next question is from Eve.
So I have read that you have said the human observer constitute the final link in the chain of observational processes, and the properties of any atomic object can be understood only in terms of the object's interaction with the observer. From a permaculture viewpoint, principle one is observe and interact. Do you see this as one of the same?
Yeah, I must say, if this is an amazing question from a 12-year-old. I'm really impressed.
I surround myself with wonderful young people, I have to say.
And it's a really interesting question. And the answer is that it's not the same. There's a difference. And this difference leads us right into the heart of quantum theory. And I don't think we can go there. But I was thinking when I looked at your questions that, you know, someday maybe we can have a special session just on quantum physics, because it's quite complex. And if you're interested in that, I'd be happy to go further. But let me answer your question. The difference is the following. When you look at a field, a permaculture field or anything else, the process of observation does not influence what you are observing. So the field is just there and the plants grow and you observe them growing and then you interact. So first you observe and then to interact. Well, when you observe an atom, it's very different, because an atom, of course, is so small that you can't see it. And let me just interrupt here for a second and show you how small an atom is. Give you an analogy. And this is from my book, The Tao of Physics. And I brought an orange here, okay? So let me ask you, how many atoms are in this orange? And in order to answer that, let's imagine to blow up the orange, to make it larger and larger until we can see the atoms. So if we blow it up to the size of my room, we still can't see the atoms. To the size of my house, we can't see the atoms. To the size of California, we can't see the atoms. So we go to the whole Earth, to the entire planet. In an orange of the size of the planet, the atoms have the size of cherries. Okay? So imagine our whole planet Earth tightly packed with cherries. That's the magnified image of the orange. So then imagine, close your eyes and imagine shrinking the Earth down to the orange, and you see how small the atoms become. So atoms, there's no way we can see them. So in order, how do we observe them? Well, to shine light on an atom means to bombard it with photons, which are the particles of light. And if you bombard an atom, if you hit it with photons, which means you transfer energy from these photons to the atom, which changes the structure of the atom. So the very act of observation is always already an interaction. And how you see the atom or how you observe the atom depends on what kind of observational apparatus you use. This is why you can't separate the act of observation from the interaction. And this is the first thing which was so striking to those physicists. You know, one of the big puzzles, just to tell you that, and then let's go on to the other questions, but just to tell you that, one of the big puzzles in the early days of quantum physics in the 1920s was that subatomic particles, like electrons, for instance, appeared sometimes as particles and sometimes as waves. And they just couldn't figure out, were they particles or were they waves? And the answer was, it depends on how you observe them. Because, as I said before, with the observation, you influence them. And the way I put it in my book, if you ask them a particle question, you will get a particle answer. If you ask them a wave question, you will get a wave answer. In other words, the way you set up your experimental apparatus determines whether the electron will show itself as a particle or as a wave. This was the very beginning of this exciting period of quantum physics of the 1920s. So it's a great question, and it can lead to a lot of explorations.
The concept of regenerative gardening has evolved from a combination of sustainable / regenerative agriculture and agroecology, agroforestry, and sustainable gardening using permaculture ethics. Some people say that the place to be in gardening is no longer just in sustainability, it's being regenerative. Do you feel that this is a true statement, and do you have any thoughts on the benefits of regenerative gardening and farming?
Yeah, again, this is a fantastic question and a very important one. And I have the same experience here in California. People more and more says, sustainability, that's such an outdated word, and what we really need is regenerative agriculture and the regenerative economics and so on. Now, I must tell you that I really like the term regenerative because it's very evocative. It is immediately understandable, whereas sustainability is not immediately understandable. But to say that, as some people do, that to talk about sustainable agriculture is really wrong, we should talk about regenerative agriculture, that's sort of an erroneous perception that sustainability means to sustain what we have, to sustain the status quo. And if you understand life from a systems point of view, you can easily see that regeneration is an essential property of life. And, you know, in my online course, I have a lecture where I have a little table and I have a rock on the table, a crystal, and I have a plant. And so then I ask my students, what's the essential difference between a rock and a plant? And, you know, after some back and forth, I explained to them that living organisms like plants or animals or humans need a constant stream of energy and matter to survive. You know that we need air to breathe, we need food, we need water, we need liquids, and that's the truth. That's true for all living organisms. So there's a constant stream of energy and matter through the living organism. And that constant stream of energy and matter is called metabolism in science. Are you familiar with that term? Have you heard that before? Metabolism, great. So metabolism is defined as the constant flow of energy and matter through a network of chemical reactions, which allows a living organism to continually maintain and regenerate itself. So regeneration is the very definition of life. You cannot have life without regeneration. And therefore, to say that nature sustains life means that nature regenerates life. life continually regenerates itself. And when I thought about this question, I also thought about Leonardo da Vinci. One thing that I did, which I didn't mention in my introduction, is that I spent 10 years studying the writings of Leonardo da Vinci. So I don't know what you know about Leonardo. He was a painter in the Renaissance. His most famous painting is the Mona Lisa, which you will have heard of. Yeah. He was also a brilliant engineer. He designed a lot of very innovative machines, and he was a brilliant scientist. And that last part is not very well known. So I contributed to introducing Leonardo as a scientist, and I want to read you a passage that he wrote, and this is from one of the books I wrote about him, which is called Learning from Leonardo. And this is what he wrote about the Earth. And this was in the 15th century. So this was about 500 years ago. And he wrote the following. Feathers grow on birds and change every year. Hairs grow on animals, and every year they change. Grass grows in the fields and leaves on the trees, and every year they largely renew themselves. And from this, he concluded that the earth is a living organism. And he says, he goes on, we may therefore say that the earth has a vital force of growth. And he goes on, you know, describing the earth as a living organism. So he was a real pioneer in this view of life being regenerative, which I find very remarkable. But, you know, what I do when I talk about sustainability, and now you both, and I say, you know, we need a sustainable regenerative agriculture, or, you know, a sustainable regenerative economics, or healthcare system, and so on. So I use both terms because I really like the term regenerative. But this does not deny the nature of sustainability.
I think that's a really great response, because it has created a little bit of, I feel, friction somewhere in the conversations that happen, and it really, at this point, we can't be having that kind of conversation which diminishes what we're doing. We really need the conversation that brings all of that work together so that we can move forward with more strength. Absolutely. And to help get the political will behind the movement.
Yeah. Well, if life did not regenerate itself, it could not go on existing. Like you can artificially stop the regeneration. If you take a plant or a bird or a fly or any kind of organism and put it, you know, under a bowl in a vacuum, it will die, you know, immediately. A plant, not immediately, but after a short time, because the regenerative process is stopped. So in order to sustain life, you have to make it possible for life to regenerate itself.
How can we shift from rational linear thinking to ecological non-linear thinking?
Well, there are, speaking as a scientist and mathematician, you know, there's a non-linear mathematics, there are many kind of non-linearity. But what we mean, and what I understand that you mean in your question, is the kind of nonlinear thinking that is thinking in terms of networks, because this is the main shift in the emergence of the new paradigm, the shift from the machine to the network. So how do we practice thinking in terms of networks? Well, I think what I would suggest is that we ask ourselves continually, when we look at a phenomenon or an event in the news or whatever, we ask how it is related to other things. That practices the nonlinear thinking. So, for example, why is organically grown food more expensive than industrially grown food? If you go to a supermarket, you will see, at least here in California, there are sections of organically grown food, and fortunately they get larger and larger and more markets, but they are more expensive than the industrially grown food. Now, it doesn't really make sense, because organically grown food has fewer energy inputs and has fewer chemical inputs. There's actually no chemical inputs. And it is locally grown, so fewer transportation costs. So it should be cheaper, not more expensive. Well, if you look into the food system, you see that the industrial agriculture has a lot of government support, of subsidies, because they are large companies. They have political power. They bribe politicians to move funds in a certain direction. They influence the tax system. So you see a lot of connections to politics, to ethics in politics, to corporate behavior, and so on. Just from seeing that, you know, a piece of broccoli organically grown, you know, costs a few dollars more than you know, a piece of industrial broccoli. So just to go and find out what these connections are. Another thing you could ask, staying with food, is what additional costs does industrial agriculture create? So the food is cheaper, but do we have to pay in another way? For example, the industrial food, which is often full of toxic chemicals, is much unhealthier than the organic food. So we have health costs of obesity, of diabetes, of strokes, and other illnesses that are directly related to our diet. What about the pollution caused by industrial agriculture, which is significant, the runoffs of nitrogen and other chemicals? What about the health of the farm workers that work in those fields? So these are all additional costs that should be really included in the price of food, because they are necessary to produce food in this way. Another example would be to look at products that companies offer you for free and ask exactly the same question. How do I pay in another way? Because nothing is really free. Now, I can offer you a gift, or you can offer me a gift. In the exchange between human beings, yes, there are free. There's a lot of free gifts that we give. But when it comes to companies and corporations, it's usually not free. It's advertised as free. But for example, when Amazon offers delivery of something you buy for free within 2 days, who pays for this short delivery and free delivery? Is it the drivers with added stress because they have to drive faster and in a more intense, longer working hours and so on, higher rates of accidents? Is it all of us pay with increase of pollution? What about the warehouse employees in these huge hangars that Amazon has with terrible working conditions, low pay, and so on? So all this pays for this supposedly free delivery. So this is how you train yourself. You practice systemic thinking by always asking, how are things connected to other things? And, you know, what's behind it all? It's not easy to do, but it's something that I do have done for a very long time. Another technique is to draw conceptual maps, which are also called mind maps, where you put concepts and ideas on a piece of paper and then interconnect them with lines. That's a very good technique also to practice this nonlinear thinking. But it's not easy.
We've been practicing lately too with warm data conversations. So using Nora Bateson's kind of approach.
Oh, great.
That's been really, you know, getting that sort of transcontextual understanding of ideas. So we've been using that as a way to have conversations with teens around the world, which has been a really
great
fun process too. So thanks, Richof. I'm wondering.
Let me ask you something, both Maya and Eve. You know, you belong to a generation who has grown up with social media. I don't know how old you were when you first used them, but you live in this world of social networks. I mean, you are very aware of being connected to networks in your everyday lives. Every time you pick up your phone, I don't know how much you use your phone, but every time you pick it up, you're connected to a network. Now, it would seem that you would find it easier to think in terms of networks because of this experience. And I wonder whether that's true. I mean, it's probably difficult for you to compare your thinking to that of others who haven't grown up in networks like myself. But can you say anything about that? Or Maura, can you anything about saying about, you know, interacting with this young generation and communicating with them.
I'll let Maya and Eve answer first, and then maybe I can respond as well.
I don't really use social media that much, but from what I do, it's actually, I think for me, it's less network because it's very one-dimensional. Like there's no, you can't see their faces and it's just the words on a page usually. Uh-huh. For like messaging apps and stuff, social media, like it's very hard to tell what people mean as well because, you know, there's no gestures, there's no eye contact. You can't see the face.
I see. Uh-huh.
How about you, Eve? Do you use social media at all?
I do quite a lot because I use Skype to connect with friends who don't live in my vicinity. But I get like, when you just message, you're not so much connected to them because you can't see their body language and what they're meaning because you could easily misunderstand what they mean by their words.
That's very interesting. So it is a network. The social media then is a network that extends farther than your personal face-to-face network of people. But it's impoverished at the same time. That's what you're telling us. Because you don't see the faces, you don't see gestures, you don't have the emotional dimension and so on. Yeah, that's really interesting.
So, but the thing where we are finding a level of richness, and never quite the same as being face to face, is through using this Zoom. Mm-hmm. And the Perma Youth connects via Zoom, and like I was saying before, we have people from Zanzibar and Sweden, Thailand, Philippines, UK, Germany, even the Perma Youth kids from refugee camps in Uganda join in sometimes as well. And so we have this much broader sense of, I guess, our place in the world and our reach and our capacity to change and to learn and our friendships. Our understanding of different cultures and languages and needs and what's happening in the world. For example, having a deeper context, deeper understanding of the context of the refugees, for example, and that, you know, we just learned the other week that their rations have been cut by half. And so we're now supporting them directly through helping them to access materials to do urgent kitchen gardens. And so these relationships form by having these networks over social media, but particularly when there's more texture to it, like this visual, like we can create more of a relationship when we have more of that warm data.
Yeah. Interesting.
I remember we were just talking about how we belong online and stuff, that kind of related to my question about what does it mean to belong?
Yes, I think in my view, to belong means to be a member of a community, to belong to a community. And when you belong to a community, you behave in a certain way. And this, I found this very interesting, and I have looked into this quite a bit in my research into the systems view of life. When you have a community, then you show that you are a member of the community by behaving in a certain way. And actually, this is a very natural human activity. You know, even small children learn that very fast. Well, for instance, you may remember, you know, when you go to your grandma's house, you behave differently at your grandma's house than you do at your own house. You can do either more things, you are allowed to do more things, or the grandma is stricter, whatever. It's different. When you go somewhere else and join another family, when you have friends and you have a sleepover, something like this, it's different than in your own home because it's a different community. And the interesting thing is that by behavior in a certain way, you embody your membership in the community. And at the same time, the community creates a boundary between those who belong and those who do not belong. Another example would be in youth culture. You know, there are many youth who form groups or cliques or whatever. And to show that you're part of the group, you're dressed in a certain way. You wear your hair in a certain way. You tie your shoes in a certain way. There are hundreds of little things that young people do to show that they belong to a community. Language, of course. You use a certain slang. You use certain words, you know. You use certain greeting rituals, whatever. So, and this is what actually is known as culture. You know, social scientists, this is how they define culture. A set of shared beliefs and habits and norms of behavior, language, and so on. So when you belong to a community, you behave in a certain way. Now, in our daily lives, we all belong to several communities, maybe to many communities, but all of us share two communities to which we belong, two large communities. We're all members of humanity, and we belong to the biosphere, the community of life. And as such, we should behave in a certain way that shows that we belong to these communities. To belong to humanity means that we should respect human rights and human dignity. And to belong to the biosphere, to the community of life, means that we should respect ecological sustainability. And in both cases, the behavior is behavior for the common good, which is what is also known as ethical behavior. I don't know how much you came across discussions of ethics, but they're usually held within philosophy or religion. But there is a much more general sense of ethics, which is always related to community. So ethical behavior is always behavior on behalf of the community. It's behavior for the common good. And that, to me, is the most important meaning of belonging.
One of the things I just wanted to mention about that, too, that we, in the PermaYouth, we have quite a lot of conversations around ethics because the core part of permaculture is this set of three ethics, which is earth care, people care, and fair share. And so what that's, you know, obviously earth care, caring for the planetary systems, caring for the biosphere, people care, caring for ourselves, for family, for others. And fair share is really looking at that question of, well, how can we live within a certain means so that, or diminish the footprint that we have so that it leaves enough space and resources for other people, for other cultures, other communities, and also the community of life. Yeah. And so these three ethics are the foundation of then these set of principles of design, which are based on the principles of ecology, and then applying that into how we design human systems flow through that.
Well, this is really interesting to me because I just said a minute ago that the two communities to which we belong imply a respect of human dignity, human rights, and sustainability. And you can associate sustainability with earth care and human dignity, with people care and human rights, with fair share.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Fits beautifully.
Yeah.
Abundance is one of my favorite words. From my 12-year-old point of view, I see that the major problems of our time is climate change, food security, replenishing soils to sequester carbon out of the atmosphere, and producing enough energy. I see these problems as interconnected. In our permaculture garden at home, with my family, we are trying to tackle all these problems systemically, independently as a whole. Do you think we as global citizens, can tackle these problems using interconnectivity on a large scale?
Yes, well, I totally agree with you what you say about the interconnectedness of the problem. That's what I mentioned before in the beginning, that the major problems of our time are systemic problems, which means that they're all interconnected and interdependent. And, you know, the important thing to realize is they cannot be solved in isolation, which means that systemic problems require corresponding systemic solutions, meaning solutions that look at every problem in terms of how it's connected to other problems, that solve a particular problem within the context of other problems. And this means that typically systemic solutions solve several problems at the same time, because in addressing one, they also address how it's connected to others. And when I give my courses and seminars, I always present agriculture and you know, agroecology or permaculture, you know, regenerative agriculture as an excellent example of a systemic solution. Because, and I explained that if we shifted from industrial agriculture to permaculture and agroecology on a large scale globally, we would solve at least three current problems or contribute significantly to solving them. One is energy, because, you know, permaculture and agroecology don't have this huge energy input that we now have with industrial agriculture. Two is the health issue that I mentioned already. The food is much healthier. Therefore, it would have significant impact on public health. And three is what we haven't talked about yet, is it would contribute significantly to address the climate emergency, because as you know, an organic soil is a living soil full of carbon, which means that it draws down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and locks it up in organic substances. So, you know, these three issues are addressed with just one solution. And so when I researched this over the last 10, 20 years, I found that around the world, in the civil society organizations, in the NGOs around the world, people have developed hundreds of these systemic solutions. And in my textbook, The Systems View of Life, I spend about maybe 60 pages reviewing the most important of these systemic solutions. So they exist all around the world. And I come to the conclusion that today we have the knowledge, the technologies, and the financial means to move toward a sustainable future. What we need is political will and leadership. That's all we need.
And there was a quote from your book. I think it was from the very early pages of your textbook that you're saying that there are solutions to the major problems of our time, and some even simple. I think, you know, it's actually to not overcomplicate things, but actually to see where there's some very simple, straightforward solutions that we already have, and that you go on to say, but they require a radical shift in our perceptions, our thinking, and our values. And then that leads into really that, I guess that then shapes our will, doesn't it? If we perceive our relationship differently, if we understand, if we have a different set of values, we make different decisions and we lead from a different position.
Yeah. Yes, you know, if we realize and really experience that we are connected to the entire community of life, then we also realize what we do to the community of life, we do to ourselves. And therefore, just from a value of self-preservation and you know, growth and development, we would take care or you know, be responsible in our actions toward the community of life, because you know, it comes back to us. It doesn't take a great willpower, you know, to be gentle to the community of life if you realize that we are inseparable part of it, you know.
How important is shifting cultural norms and expectations with how we interact with the world, and how can we amplify these changes that are happening to meet the scale of the crisis? And also, is this the right question to be asking?
Yes, absolutely. This is a very important question. And, you know, we have talked about community, we have talked about networks, we have talked about interconnecting networks, as you do in the Burma Youth Movement, and I think that's the answer. That's what we have to do. We have to educate ourselves, we have to educate others, and we have to interconnect our networks.
With all of nature's complexities and abundance, do you think we as a whole work with nature and come together to respect what nature can teach us?
Well, I think it should be clear now from our conversation that working with nature is our only chance. If we want to survive as a human civilization, we have to change our ways, you know, dramatically, and work with nature rather than, you know, trying to dominate her and control her. And this, by the way, is completely related to this shift of metaphors from the machine to the network. Because if nature were really a machine, the proper attitude would be to control her. You know, if you drive a car, then you had better control the car, because otherwise you get into danger. No, or, you know, if you use a sewing machine, this is maybe no longer something you kids do, but when I was your age, we were fascinated by sewing machines, and we secretly, you know, we secretly went into the place where our parents' sewing machines, my grandmother's sewing machine particularly, and we tried to take it apart and put it together again. And all these bobbins with the threads and so on was fascinating. We didn't have computers, of course, in those days. And so to control a machine is the proper attitude. But if the world is a living network, then to control this living network is not the proper attitude. The proper attitude is to communicate, to collaborate, to cooperate. And that's what we have to do. Now, Fortunately, and that's another piece of good news, I'm sure that you are aware of, there is a huge movement of so-called eco-design and of biomimicry, of mimicking nature to learn how to build structures and materials. And let me just use a couple of examples. When you watch spiders build their webs and spin their threads, then you can find out that the strength of a silk string produced by a spider, pound per pound, is greater than the strength of steel. So a steel wire is weaker per weight than the silk spider. Now, steel, as you know, is produced with a great deal of heat, a great deal of energy input, fossil fuels, of course, and a lot of noise and so on in these steel plants. The spider does it all at room temperature and silently, right? So if we could produce threads like the spider, you know, would be a huge progress. Well, this has actually happened. I don't know whether you heard that story. Two women, I think it was either in Sweden or in Norway, two scientists studied this process of how the spider produces the silk strings, the threads, and they were able to identify a particular protein and then use this protein for synthetic production of spider silk by inserting the protein into a certain bacterium and then cultivate these bacteria who would then spin this silk. And so now we can produce this spider silk in massive amounts. And I've seen pictures of tennis shoes, for instance, that are made out of that and other things. So that's just one example. And another example, which I find very amazing, is about plastics. You know, one of the big challenges is to create biodegradable plastics. And a company in Mexico has found that they can use avocado seeds to produce biodegradable plastics. I don't know. Do you have avocados in Australia?
Right here in this climate, it's a major tree.
So in Mexico, as you may know, it's a big part of Mexican cuisine. The avocados are used to produce what is called guacamole, which is a major part of Mexican cuisine. And in Mexico, there are tons and tons of avocado seeds that used to be discarded as waste. Well, now they use them to produce biodegradable plastic. You know, again, learning from nature. And I want to mention something to you, which I don't know whether you know. I subscribe to an online journal, which is called The Optimist Daily. Have you heard about that?
No, I think we'll subscribe to that. Yeah.
So Google The Optimist Daily and, as the name says, it comes out daily and it has daily good news of sustainable solutions. It's really a fabulous. The examples I mentioned were taken from this magazine. I read it every day and then I take excerpts and it's really a fantastic magazine.
Wonderful. Thank you for that link. We were just talking the other day about how we need to have more good news stories and
that's what we need.
So we have a society that doesn't particularly like death, but how do we embrace it in an ecological systems approach?
Yeah, that's also a really interesting question. I think I have a really interesting answer for you. So when you and I relate it to what we talked about when we talked about regeneration. So remember that the very essence of life is to regenerate itself. Life could not exist without continually regenerating itself. So in a living organism, we have tissues, we have organs, we have cells, And at each level, we have systems within systems, living systems within living systems. And at each level, there is constant regeneration. So, for example, our body continually regenerates our bodily cells. The cells continually die off and new cells are born. And so this makes our skin smooth and our internal organs well functioning, this continual regeneration and continual recycling. So for the organism, for the human organism or any kind of animal or plant organism, that continual regeneration is the very essence of life. But for the individual cells, if we move to the level of cells, that regeneration is a cycle of life and death. Right? So the cells die continually and are reborn continually, so that at a higher level, the organism continues to live. So maybe that's true at all levels of life. So maybe death and life are not opposites, but death is really part of life. Death, the fact that we all are born and live and get old and die is regenerative for society, for humanity as a whole, and ultimately for the community of life. So that's the positive view of life and death.
How can we help balance the yin and yang?
Yeah, that is a question. Actually, I loved it, and I, when you sent this to me, I didn't know what to say initially. I had to meditate it a little bit, but then I came up with something which is really a new idea that I haven't had before, and I'm very grateful to you for asking the question because it led me to something new. So in my understanding of these Chinese terms, which are very important in Chinese philosophy, the yang describes qualities of expansion, of competition, of extraction, and as an umbrella term, you can call them qualities of self-assertion, expanding, competing, asserting ourselves. The yin describes qualities of conservation, of cooperation, of regeneration, and as an umbrella term, you could say qualities of integration. So you have self-assertion and integration. And the new idea that I had is that the self-assertion can be associated with the individual, and the integration can be associated with the community. And we need both. We need to assert ourselves as individuals, and we need to integrate ourselves into the life of our communities. And so since in the world of today, we have an imbalance, too much yang and not enough yin, too much self-assertion and not enough integration, the way to enhance the integration or the yin, the way to achieve a greater balance is to emphasize the importance of community. And I can tell you that in recent years, I've been speaking and writing more and more about the importance of community. And there are many reasons why community is so important. And this is one of them, which I didn't realize before. So in order to practice our integrative qualities, we can do that by enhancing the importance of community. Great. So thank you again for the question. That was a great question.
What do you think we need to change to be able to tackle the major problems of our time?
Well, I think we really have talked about that. This is really sort of a summary question. I think we need to change our thinking and to change our values. And just to repeat, the thinking is from linear to network thinking, from mechanistic thinking to systemic thinking in terms of relationships, of patterns, of context. And the values are the values that are characteristic of you know, individuals displaying when they belong to two particular communities, humanity and the community of life, the biosphere. And these are the values of respecting human dignity, respecting human rights, and respecting ecological sustainability. Now, to actually lay this out in detail, what does this mean in detail, respecting human rights, respecting sustainability, is quite a task, because life is complex, and as you said, and it has many levels and many dimensions. But fortunately, we have a magnificent document that has done that, lay out the values of, you know, respect of human dignity, human rights, ecological sustainability, and that's the Earth Charter. I don't know whether you are familiar with the Earth Charter, but it's a fantastic document that was created about 20 years ago in a very unique process of global collaboration of many organizations, individuals, and communities. And the Earth Charter is a declaration of 16 ethical principles and values to create a world that is sustainable, just, and peaceful. That's how they describe it. And I recommend it very highly, and this would be a very good working document for you guys for, you know, exploring ethics and values.
Fantastic. We will do that. That's great. We have a weekly newsletter that goes out. We've been exploring each of the ethics and the principles of permaculture. We've just finished that, so it's a perfect time to start exploring the Earth Charter now. And yeah. I'm diving in to ask a little question here.
Let me tell you first, Morag, that I have a talk about the Earth Charter, which includes a conceptual map, so you see how its principles are interrelated. And I will send that to you.
Thank you.
So you can use that.
We can share that out through the PermU.
Yeah, absolutely. We can have
a study group around that. That's great. I wanted to ask you then another set of goals, I suppose, is that the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, so that's come more recently. Do you feel that that's a really useful tool as a, I guess, as I was talking to Mae East, who I believe was one of the authors of it. She was, Maya and I met her recently from Gaia Education, and she was saying that she sees the SDGs as a kind of a framework, and that permaculture, she's seen around the world, that it's often kind of the pathway to implement the SDGs. And I'm just wondering if you'd, where does the SDGs sit in your thinking of a way of it?
Well, I have thought about them. I thought about them quite a lot last year, because I got an invitation from the United Nations to produce a video about the SDGs and about the importance of systems thinking to apply the SDGs. And so I, with a group of Capricorse alumni, we produced this video, and the story is that we produced a simple video with a simple presentation that I gave, and we had a working group. And one of the members of this group is a communications designer living here in the Bay Area. And he said, well, this video is very poorly done because, you know, there are no visuals and it's just talking head and so on. So he was actually quite impolite, you know, in his critique. But then he said, I could maybe help you to improve it. And as time went on, he sort of headed this study group and produced a lot of images, and they did a lot of research, and all for free. You know, it was all voluntary work. So now the video, the end result is a professionally produced video with, you know, music, images, and everything. And if you want to watch it, you can go to the Capricorse website. On the homepage, you will have a trailer of the Capricorse. And underneath the trailer is a Vimeo page. It's a link to our Vimeo page. And the video is called The Heart of the Matter. And so it has been seen by thousands of people. And I'm actually somewhat surprised that you haven't seen it yet.
I have seen it, but I was it just popped out of my mind connecting it to this question.
So my main point is that since, as I said before, since the major problems of the world are all interconnected, the solutions need to be interconnected too. Therefore, the SDGs need to be interconnected. And they are conceptually, but practically they are not, because people tend to sort of live in their silos and say, well, now let's do SDG number 3, and now let's do SDG number 7, and so on. And also there is a big problem with the SDGs, which I also address in the video, and that is that the SDG number 8 advocates economic growth in a very uncritical way. If they had said, we need qualitative economic growth, or, you know, improvement, development, you know, that would have been okay. But they just say economic growth and leave it like this. And that negates all the rest of it if you were to adopt it. So the SDGs have their problems, but it's a good effort and they can be, you know, worked on.
Yes, I know. That one always stands out to me is this glaring mismatch amongst the rest. That's right. Yeah. So we will also share that video with the rest of the PermaYouth. I think Eve and Maya, that would be a really great focal point for discussion. Yeah, fantastic.
Maybe you can create a new set of Perma SDGs, you know.
That's a great idea. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm just thinking if there's any final questions, maybe. We've been talking for 1 hour 40 and I so appreciate your time. Yeah, your
time flies when you're in good company.
Oh, my gosh, it has, isn't it?
How can we learn from intuitive wisdom of ancient traditions?
Well, I mentioned at the beginning that, you know, in my life as a physicist, I noticed very striking parallels between modern physics and ancient Eastern wisdom. So, and then I investigated those and wrote a book about them. And so I think this is very fertile ground. Systemic thinking is not, you know, limited to science or to, you know, people in the networks we have talked about. But many indigenous traditions embody a vision of the world in terms of relationships, in terms of networks. There is a very famous phrase of Native American thinking, which talks about nature in terms of all my relations. And when you look at that from a science point of view, you can take this literally. Because as Darwin has shown us, we all derive from a common living ancestor. And so when we say that the plants and animals in our environment are our cousins, that is literally true, genetically true. And so we can learn a lot from this ancient wisdom. So we can study the traditions and we can also practice the various disciplines that they have developed. For example, I have been very attracted to Taoism and I have practiced Tai Chi, a Taoist meditative practice for a long time, for many decades. You can study, you know, Hinduism and practice yoga. Of course, you can also practice yoga without studying Hinduism, but you can do both. And when it comes to living indigenous traditions, the situation is maybe a little more difficult because there are political dimensions associated with them about human rights and suppression and so on. But I think we can begin by respecting them and by acknowledging the value of those traditions. And again, maybe you in Australia with the PermaYouth movement, you can do some pioneering work here because you have a very rich Aboriginal traditions in Australia. And so the question is, are you in contact with them or do you plan to be in contact with them? I'm actually very curious about that.
We have an elder here who came to our first camp and talked about Indigenous culture, Wurunga. And I've just met and connected with an amazing cultural ecologist, an Indigenous woman from south of here who she has a PhD in Indigenous seasons and plants and Indigenous agriculture. And so trying to work out a time to connecting with her. So very much thinking about how we can connect with local Indigenous culture.
Well, I have worked a lot in education, and Morag knows that I'm the co-founder of an organization called Center for Eco-Literacy, promoting the idea of ecological literacy, of knowing about ecology, the principles of ecology. And we have worked very closely for many years with an Indigenous so-called wisdom teacher, a Canadian woman called Jeanette Armstrong, who is an Okanagan member of the Okanagan Nation in British Columbia. And so we have worked a lot with her in developing teaching methods for the Center for Ecoliteracy. So this has been a very fruitful collaboration. So I would encourage you to go in this direction.
I think what we're doing at the moment with PermaYouth is making connections, building the relationships, and just seeing what kind of emerges through those generative conversations and following curiosities and opening up to new things. And it's a really quite wonderful process and experience to be involved in.
Yeah.
And thank you so much.
I have a story to tell you. I talked about Jeanette Armstrong, and I will tell you the story of our first meeting. So this was actually before the Center for Ecoliteracy existed. I founded another organization called the Elmwood Institute, and we started the Ecoliteracy program within the Elmwood Institute in the early 1990s. And so that's when we met Jeanette, and we invited her to a board meeting of the Elmwood Institute to discuss how we could collaborate in education. And so we sat around in a circle and we said, well, let's first introduce ourselves. And we asked her to introduce herself, right? And so she said, well, I'm an Okanagan elder from British Columbia, from the Okanagan Valley. And then she said, and my father was part of the mountain people. And then she described this mountain ecosystem that her father came from. And then he said, and my mother was part of the valley people. And she described the ecosystem of the valley that her mother came from. And she went on for about 20 minutes, just introducing herself in ecological terms. And then she said, and now I would like to hear from you, who you are. And she said, don't tell me about your academic degrees and don't tell me about the books you wrote. Tell me about who you really are. And we all ended up crying, you know, because it was such an unusual way of going to the very heart of who we are that it was very unusual. So it's very moving and very inspiring, you know, to have interactions with Indigenous people.
Mm.
And
that's a great story, isn't it? Because we often get caught in our scripts and you know, our positioning, whereas, you know, actually describing ourselves in our relationships and our ecological relationships
Really another very brief story is from which I haven't witnessed, but somebody told me about it. Another group, another organization had a meeting with indigenous elders, and they had a certain schedule for the meeting and a certain program. And they told the Native Americans, well, this is what we have in mind for this meeting, you know? And then one of the elders said, smiling, he said, well, I suggest that what you do first is you take off your watches, you know?
Get out of that sort of rich time.
And then they completely restructured the meeting.
Yeah, very nice. Oh, gosh. Well, thank you so very much, Fridtjof, for taking the time to answer these questions and to explore new ideas and open up the permanent into the world of systems thinking and really ground it in something that feels, I don't know, really significant.
So great. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you, Maya and Eve, for your fabulous questions. They were really inspiring, and I hope I helped you to learn something. I certainly did.
Mm.
And let's do it again sometime. Okay?
All right, everybody. Thank you so much, Fridtjof. So thanks for tuning in to the Sense Making in a Changing World podcast today. It's been a real pleasure to have your company. I invite you to subscribe and receive notification of each new weekly episode with more wonderful stories, ideas, inspiration, and common sense for living and working regeneratively. And call positive permaculture thinking and design into action in this changing world. I'm including a transcript below and a link also to my four-part permaculture series, really looking at what is permaculture and how to make it your livelihood too. So join me again in the next episode where we talk with another fascinating guest. I look forward to seeing you there.